ודבר שבועתיו So before we begin, in order to give people a chance to make a graceful exit, should they so choose, no, I really feel I need to say this, a little bit of a disclaimer. The title of the talk is both botched and ambiguous, not necessarily in that order. So let me explain. It was supposed to read Art Scroll and the Jewish Problem. And then I saw it typed like this, and I asked the fellow to change it, and he didn't change it, and that's how it ended up, Art Scroll, : the Jewish Problem. Now, Baruch Hashem, before coming here, I did check to make sure that my speaker's malpractice insurance policy is in order, and so therefore, for having bashed, or perhaps seeming to have bashed a pomegranate in my talk last night, and perhaps Art Scroll in my talk this evening, I'm fully covered, so that's not going to be a problem in case I get a lawyer's letter to cease and desist. But having said that, Art Scroll and the Jewish Problem, will explain in a moment a little bit what I'm alluding to. But in fact, the talk is going to be, it's impossible to tell, of course, in the title what the talk is about, which is a favorite speaker's trick in order to pack the crowds, because, you know, keep them off balance. They have no idea what it might really be about. So now you know that it's going to be about Limud HaTorah, about Torah study, and its connection to Amunah, and things that perhaps we could be doing better in that area, to some extent. And I'll try to keep it low octane and try not to go off the deep end when we get to that point. But of course, Art Scroll and the Jewish Problem is an allusion to the famous Jewish joke, which has a, like most of the best Jewish jokes, has a kernel of anti-Semitism in it. But of course, we tell it about ourselves, so no one can say anything. And that is, of course, about the teacher who assigned in composition class in college, and he assigned an essay and wanted to leave it open-ended. So he said he asked the class to submit essays on the topic of elephants. And you can write whatever you want about elephants. And then finally the assignment was due, and the various students handed in their essays, and one fellow, McGinley, handed in an essay about the social proclivities of elephants, and Spinelli handed in something about the culinary habits of elephants, and Goldstein handed in his essay, and the title was Elephants and the Jewish Problem. So basically, it all comes down to the Jewish problem. Anything in the world relates to the Jewish problem. So I think perhaps when we get to the end of the talk, I'd like to suggest that perhaps there is some connection. It does make sense to say Art Scroll and the Jewish Problem. Perhaps Art Scroll is certainly not the Jewish problem in any sense whatsoever. But perhaps there are some problems that may be related to how we relate to Art Scroll, and of course I mean Art Scroll in the sense of the Art Scroll, the phenomenon of what Art Scroll means in a larger sense for the contemporary from community. And with that, let's begin. So the real question, of course, is why a session on Limud HaTorah in a weekend devoted to the topic of Emunah, an impassioned Emunah? And I think the simple answer to that really is that the single greatest experiential form of Emunah is to learn Torah. We can talk about intellectual attainment of Emunah. We can talk about emotional attainment of Emunah, passionate Emunah. But if you want to experience Emunah in your entire being, there's nothing like living and learning. There's nothing like when a person is deeply immersed in a sugya, when a person has been learning and learning and learning for hours on end, building. And when a person does that, he doesn't believe in God. He knows there's a God with his entire being. He's experiencing it. More, he's not just experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but when you reach that point, everything else in the world, we talk about one of the problems in Emunah is there's so many other things out there to believe. People are trying to get us to believe so many different things out there. But when you're deeply immersed in learning to that extent, when you're in the thick of learning Torah, so everything else melts away. Everything else pales into insignificance. You're moyes in other things. Other things become are revealed for the nonsense they truly are. What gives me the right to say that? Well, I must admit that on one level I can say it because I've experienced some form of it here and there, then and now. And so have many other people that I know. At the point when you get into learning deeply in that way, I have some level of that. Can't say it became, you know, this overwhelming, earth-shaking experience. But yes, but you feel that. You feel that. You really have that experiential form of emunah. But I know it also because there was a Yid who lived in Eretz Yisrael, named Rav Avraham Yeshayahu Karelitz, the Chazei Nish, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And he wrote voluminously about Talmud Torah and its effects on the person in many letters and in other places in his writings. And there are many statements of his, expressions of feeling. I mean, his poetry was something, just a thing of beauty. To read his letters is really just an experience, a romp in poetry. And he writes Kiseder about this. V'acherei she'hodom mis'anel z'man mu'a b'tayra. When a person toils for just a little bit of time in Tayra, kaina avas atayra, he comes to possess a love of Tayra, who mis'avelum atayra yaisa mikol tanu v'yelo. And he is pining. His desire to learn Torah becomes greater than that of all the desires of the world. A commensurate with the amount of toil and the amount of exertion that a person invests in searching for wisdom, in seeking out knowledge. To that very same extent, I can't even really translate. It's you really have to just savor the Chazon Ish, his words. A person will be submerged. He'll be marinating in avas achochma, in the pure love of wisdom, for wisdom's sake. Until he will be repulsed, he will recoil from, because miske geshen tach zashemesh, from all the so-called sweet things that exist under the sun. Not because, it's not that a good corned beef on club with a side of French, maybe with a pickle, maybe even with a celery soda. Not because, it's a recoil from it. It's because the truth is, you and I know, there really is nothing to a corned beef sandwich on club, with a pickle, with a side of French, with a celery soda. There's nothing really there. There's a little thin membrane that the Yetzer Hara is able to drag over our eyes and make us think, it's like a schmack. We know the second it's done, we realize we've been had. We really do realize we've been had again by the master con artist. So when you lead deeply in learning, so you realize it mitchila. You don't need to wait till after the corned beef. You realize what is it already? This is the real thing, as Koch once upon a time said. When you're out in the real thing, he doesn't have the chance even to play the three card monte with you. But in any event, so what I'm saying is, when the Chazon Ish said that, when he wrote this again and again and again in his letters, by the way, to young Torah students, Be'ikr, he was writing it to 17, 18, 19 year old boys. And when he writes this, he wasn't known as a comedian. He was known as Rabbi Shekhov Ne'agayla. He wasn't writing his own experience, because that would be of no relevance to anyone else. What value is that? Why was he memorializing this for all time in his svarim? The answer is because he was expressing what a functioning Jewish soul should feel when it has the same, when it went through the same things that he did, when it toiled in Torah in the way that he did throughout his entire life. So therefore, I'm very, very comfortable not only relying on my own experience to convey this sense of what it, of experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu and an experience of the exquisite pleasures, that deep immersion in Torah, in both in quantity and quality, brings to the soul. But I'm relying, and I feel very comfortable relying on what Chazon Ish is telling us must happen, necessarily happens if you do it. And we'll get to the question of, so when do the good things start? So why are we not experiencing it more? Why are some of us not experiencing it at all? Why is it that Limud HaTorah is the single greatest experiential form of emunah? Why is it that when we're deeply in learning, that we're feeling, we're experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Reb Ber Leibovitz, Zatzal, was once at a simcha, and the speaker was holding forth an impassioned drasha about Torah. Torah, we cannot live without Torah. Torah is the very oxygen of life. Torah is to our souls what oxygen is to life. Berthier felt compelled to stand up and said, "Nay, nay, nay, not true. Torah is not oxygen. Torah is life. It's not the oxygen which makes life possible. It's not the indispensable element in life. It is life itself." So the Chaim said the same thing beautifully when the pasuk says in Dvarim about Torah, "Ki loy davareku mikem, ki hi chayechem." It jumps right out of you once the Chofetz Chaim explains what the words are saying. "Ki loy davareku mikem." It's a difficult phrase to translate, actually. It's not an empty thing from you, ki hi chayechem, but it is your life. Said the Chofetz Chaim that you can say about the spleen, I guess, you could say that if a person is missing a spleen, so he's a person, but he's a spleenless person. Various other organs, perhaps. But if a person is missing his heart, he's not a heartless person. I mean, we know some people are heartless, but he's not a person without a heart. He ain't a person. That's the person. About the Torah says, "Ki loy davareku mikem." It's not something you can either have or be bereft of. Ki hi chayechem, it is your life. Literally what Rav Baruch was saying to the pasuk, so said the Chofetz Chaim. And we know that much earlier in the Gemara, there was someone named Rabbi Yechanan, the Amir Rabbi Yechanan, who experienced the incomprehensible, unfathomable, ineffable tragedy of having lost 10 children. The Gemara Bracha says he would go around, he made it his life's mission to go around being Menachem, consoling other people that suffered losses with a small bone of his 10th child. He would say, "Dein garma da'asiro avir." Here, this is, he would sit there by the Nichon Aveilu and would say, "This is a bone for my 10th child." But this is what he would do to be Menachem people. But he was able to deal with it. He was able to go on beyond that tragedy of having lost his 10th child. And yet the Gemara Bava Metzia says that when Resh Lakish, his Chavrusa, his Talmud Chavrusa, was Nifter, he couldn't bear it. It became unbearable. He said, "Where are you? Where are you, Resh Lakish? Where are you, Resh Lakish? I cannot go on." He asked questions I couldn't answer. The risk of the rice of the Bavul Shel Torah that went on, I can't live without that. And in fact, he didn't. He expired. He left this world, the Gemara tells us. He couldn't bear it. The loss of 10 children he could bear, because that's still not life. It's precious beyond words, but it's not life. Rish Lakish, the Torah that Rish Lakish made possible, that was life. He couldn't bear that. And the truth is, Reb Baruch Ber and the Chofetz Chaim and Reb Yechanan, they really all got it from the Siddur. They got it from something that we said this evening. Ki heim chayenu v'erech yomeinu. It doesn't say ki heim avireinu. It doesn't say Torah is our oxygen. It says ki heim chayenu v'erech yomeinu. No, it's life. It's life itself. Well, why is Torah life itself, not just that which makes life possible? Because what is life, after all? Life is nothing more than the experience of the Beirei Kol Olamim. We call him Baruch Chei Olamim. He is the Chei Olamim. He is the life force of all worlds. That's all there is. Whatever we have that we call that we're alive and moving about is only because of Chelek Elokam Imal. If you want to identify life, it's the Beirei Olam. Tzadikim b'chayeyem b'misosam kuyim chayim. The righteous, even after death, are seen as being alive. Rishoyim b'chayeyem kuyim mason. The wicked, even during their lifetimes, are essentially dead. Why? Because if you're connected to the life source, v'atem advekim Hashem elokeichem, chayim kol chamayim. To the extent you are connected to life itself, the chei ho'elomim, you're alive. To the extent you're disconnected, you're not alive. There's nothing that's more closely of one with the Beirei Olam than the Torah itself. And that is the sense in which Torah is life itself, because it is the thoughts, it is the plan of the Beirei Olam himself, who is life itself. And of course, it's not just that Torah is the most direct, unmediated way of experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's not the only connection that Torah has to Emunah. It also has the connection that we all know that in order for a person to achieve Emunah, one has to have Midos Tovos. If one does not work to refine oneself, one's character traits, to free oneself of biases, it's impossible to view the world through biased spectacles and be able to see the Beirei Olam in the world. Your taivas, your ego drives will always get in the way. So a necessary predicate for achieving emunah is also to be working on tikkun amidos. And without Torah, tikkun amidos is impossible. As Mesil Shalom tells us that if Chazal prescribed and said that the sole antidote to the Eitz Hara, Barasi, the Eitz Hara, Barasi, the Torah Tavlin, if the Chazal tell us that the antidote and the sole antidote for the Eitz Hara is Torah, then it's as foolhardy to think that you're going to cure yourself of that malady called the Eitz Hara in any other means. It's as foolhardy as thinking that you're going to completely disregard doctor's orders and pharmacist prescriptions. And I'm just gonna, pick a couple of herbs from the front lawn, and I'll take that, and big deal. Not to say anything about alternative medicine here, but I'm talking about just to construct your own alternative. Nonsense. You got a serious illness. You can't cure it without Torah. So therefore, again, in that sense too, there is this intrinsic, inherent connection between Torah and Emunah, between Torah and Emunah. But this just sharpens the question for us. If that's true, as I asked before, when do the good things start? Why is it that we don't go out of our minds with delight when we learn Torah, as the Orach Chaim writes famously in his commentary on Chumash, I think in the beginning of Parshas Kislevoy? If a person really understood what he's doing, if his taste buds were fully functional, his spiritual taste buds, he would go out of his mind, go berserk with pleasure from learning Torah. So why in the world don't we? And why, in fact, do we so often feel unfulfilled and weak in Emunah? 2 hours? Right. Thank you. Okay. So why is it, in fact, if there is this such a close and necessary connection between Torah and Emunah, why is it that we feel the way we do? So we're at least just going to begin, and maybe they'll save me from myself by ending this session a little bit prematurely. But perhaps what I'm about to say is outrageous. Outrageous in a time when it's the best of times, when there are thousands of Kailalites learning Torah all over the world, Yom V'Laila, when there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of Shiurim from Balabatim, when Torah is available in every imaginable form, by hook or by crook or by nook, When tens of Sforim are being published every month, go into the Sforim stores in Eretz Yisrael or in America, you'll see tens of Sforim are being produced each month, new Sforim on the market. So perhaps it's outrageous to say, but perhaps we're not really experiencing the real thing nearly as often as we should be. You know, the American philosopher William James wrote a famous tome called The Varieties of Religious Experience. Survey of world religions, different types of religious experience that humanity has fabricated over the generations. There are varieties of religious experience within Judaism that we don't even know exist. All of us don't even know they exist. Like someone coming back with reports from the African savannah, coming back from outer space. You know, this exists. And you know it exists in your own religion, in Judaism? There are things like that. When you talk about the idea of learning for 3-4 hours, we don't have time now to abbreviate the session. I just have over here a write-up of an encounter the Chazon Ish had with two yeshiva bachim who were learning on his roof. It was Yom Narayan, they used to have davening on his roof. There was more space. And after the Yom Narayan, the chairs had remained up there, and they were learning up there. Two bachim later became Gedalei Taira. And he once went up to the roof, and he saw them battling. They were just shooting the breeze and began to talk to them. His face turned red, and he just became enraptured as he talked to them about the progressive ecstasy that builds when you're learning for 3 and 4 hours, and then 5 hours. And each one, he gave a different description of what's happening to the human being as it happens. I don't have time to read the whole thing now. And after 6 hours, and 7 hours, and 8 hours, and 9 hours, and 10 hours. It doesn't have to be a question of learning for 3-4 hours. When a person can immerse himself in a Maracha of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, when a person can get into something that he's enveloped, when he becomes enveloped in something, these are things we really don't have a connection to. I'm not even sure that we know people who have experienced these things, who can even report back from the African savannah. Okay, so you'll say, almost done. So you'll say, okay, listen, I can't hack 3 hours. What are you trying to, you know, can you spare an hour without looking at the pocket idol? Can you spare a half hour, but without picking up your head every time someone walks into the Beis Medrash or the shul to see who it is? Just a half hour, but glued. Your eyes glued to the sefer. Too much? Okay. Can you spare 10 seconds? 10 seconds. Come on, you're kidding. 10 seconds. What's 10 seconds? Well, all I know is this. That in Rabin, where Naftali Trump, the Rabin Rosh Yeshiva, who his shiurim had captivated all of Europe, when he became deathly ill, so the Bachrim mounted a campaign that everyone was going to give some time from his life for the beloved tzaddik and going from Naftali Trump, Naftali Radner. So this one gave a week of my life. I'm willing to tell the Eibishter, I'm willing to give a week of my life added on to the heilige life of Naftali. And this one gave 2 weeks. And there was a Bachar HaTzadik, he gave 2 months. Wow, everybody couldn't believe it. He's willing to give up 2 months. Nope, but yeah, we're in Radness. You have to eventually go to the Chafetz Chaim. So he went to the Chafetz Chaim, they told him what they were doing. Chafetz Chaim said, it's a Shver HaShayla, please come back tomorrow. They came back the next day. He said, you have Rebbe? He said, yeah, I can give 1 second. So, 1 second. Nobody said anything, but they were shell-shocked. They knew how much the Chofetz Chaim loved and respected Rabbi Naftali beyond words. And he's giving up 1 second? But you know what? The message was received. And they say that after that, the intensity of the learning at Rabin reached levels that it hadn't reached in 25 years before that. Because the Chofetz Chaim had taught them what 1 second of his own life meant. Yeah, I love and respect Rabbi Naftali beyond any measure. And that's why I'm giving up, Taka, a second. Okay, I think we'll have to wrap up. So, we never really did get to talk about... they're coming in already. We didn't get to talk about Art Scroll and the Jewish problem. And But I'll just end with this. It's hard to end with anything, but I'll just say that I'll just end with a maisa, and with two maisas about Rochatzko Abramsky. We'll end with that. Perhaps it's not the softest landing. It's not. I wasn't going to end with these maisas, but I have to share these maisas with you. Eitzes, practical eitzes for people like us. A bocher once became a chosin, and he came to Rochatzko Abramsky. Rochatzko Abramsky, a goyin olam, a beloved Talmud Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Reish Bezin of London, later the Rishiva Slabodka, a yid. Bokha came for a bracha. Rebbe, I want a bracha to be able to learn my whole life. Stay in learning my whole life. Chatzko said, my bracha is not going to do anything for you. But I'm already an old Jew, and I've had a lot of experience. So I'll give you an eitz instead of a bracha. He said, your whole life. And this way you'll be able to learn your whole life. He said, always learn without hachanas. Don't say, I just need to take care of this and that, and I probably should be facing this way when I say this to prevent oncoming fire from this side. But, no, I mean, it's for everyone to hear. Don't say, I'll just take care of this and that, and then I'll immediately sit down to learn. That immediately will never come. Learn without a chanas. Just be ready to learn right now. You get up in the morning, say wash your hands, say Maida Ani, say Brichta Shacha, and sit down and learn. Comes time to daven nicely. And then just sit down and learn. It's time to eat. Fine, eat, finish, and sit down and learn. Just, in other words, your default position in life should be learning. An hour unexpectedly opens up in your day, or 10 minutes. The default position is, I'm learning. I once said, Ein mayim ela tayra, Chazal, compare tayra to water. Well, those of us who experienced Hurricane Sandy or any other thing where water invaded our abodes, knows what happens with water. It fills every possible crevice you can imagine, some that you didn't know existed. It fills every possible pocket of time. Well, that's what Torah is supposed to be in a Jew's day, in a Jew's life. It's the default position. That's why Tysus in Bracha says, we don't make verses every time we sit down to learn, because it's a default position. You're really always learning. Just there are interruptions and intrusions in the day. And absolutely, some of those intrusions may take hours. If your wife needs, you know, shopping, it can take 3 hours, and if you need to watch your kids, it can take 5 hours, whatever it is. But it's the default position. That's what Chatzal said, work for me and it can work for you. The second story, we'll just end with this. Again, it's not the natural conclusion, but it's always good to end with a story, as Rabbi Krohn teaches us. And that is that Chatzal Abramsky, again, was once sitting in his apartment, which was on the Yeshiva Slabodka campus in his old age. And he thought, and in fact, virtually the whole yeshiva had emptied out that night to go to a chasana. And it was quiet. Quiet reigned on the Slobodka campus. But Chatzko was sitting in his little apartment there, learning. And all of a sudden he hears a sweet voice, one solitary voice, singing and learning in the Beis Medrash. And he wants to see, who is this? So he puts on his bathrobe and he shuffles over to the Beis Medrash and he sees like one bacher. Looks down from Ezra's Nashi, sees one bacher swaying and singing sweetly in love with his Gemara. And he goes down to the bacher, he bends down and gives him a kiss on his head. And he says, bacher, I want to tell you something. I want to tell you, you're being mekayim now one of the Memches Kinyoni HaTorah. We know that the Mishnah in Raisa, in Ovois, in Six Perek, tells us there are 48 ways to acquire Torah. And one of them is miyut derech eretz. Conventionally, of course, it's translated, it means to minimize our business dealings. The less you get the wrapped up in business, the more time you have for learning. But Reb Chatzko, with tongue planted firmly in cheek, said, what will you be mekayim miyut derech eretz? Because we all know the whole yeshiva packed out to go to a chasana. But we know a lot of times we don't really need to be at that chasana. But you know, we feel it will be a minimization of our derech eretz. Pasnish, I shouldn't go. How can I not go? You're not thrown by the miyut derech eretz. You're willing. And obviously, Reb Chatzko understood that there are interpersonal sensitivities that have to be taken into account and so on. But he felt comfortable saying to this bacher, you're not so concerned. You're willing to have a little less derech eretz. a little less involvement in the niceties of, he came to me, I have to reciprocate, it's the thing to do, and so on and so forth. Chatzkel said, I just want to tell you, I also learned in yeshiva once upon a time. I spent 6 years in Telz, and in all my 6 years I only went to two chasnas. One was my sister's. And I'm still not sure I should have gone. I'm still concerned what they're going to say when I come upstairs to Bezen Shalmaila. He said, the second one was my Rebbetzin's. I had to attend that one. He kissed him again on the forehead, and he gave him a bracha, saying that a bracha that you should grow into an Adam Gadol to whom others will come for Torah, and that your mother, who needed a refuah shleima at that time, will taka have the refuah. And both brachas were in Skyim. Thank you very much. Ha'kudavach.